Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Over the war in Iraq and facing his own tumbling poll numbers, President Bush announced a political shakeup in Washington today, saying his budget director, Joshua Bolten, will take over as White House chief of staff next month when Andrew Card, the president's sole chief of staff during his two terms as president, steps aside. The president made the announcement this morning, standing beside a sometimes tearful Andrew Card. Well, joining us first to talk about Andrew Card is his old friend and former colleague in the Massachusetts legislature here in Massachusetts, Andrew Natsios. Andrew, welcome.
How are you?
I'm fine, and we should point out you stepped down as head of the U.S. Agency for International Development back in January. You're now at Georgetown University between classes. So let's get right to it because we appreciate your time. Andrew Natsios, do you think Andy Card is taking the fall?
No, I don't think he's taking the fall. I think that these jobs in Washington are extremely high stress. And over a period of time, it takes a personal toll. Andy was probably under more stress than anybody in Washington. And he, while he's a very even-tempered man, I've never heard him raise his voice in the 30 years I've known him. The country's been through many crises, the 9/11 attack and the wars and the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, and then many, many other issues. You know, it takes a toll, and it took a toll on me. And so I realized it was time for me to do something else.
Well, and regarding Andy Card, you know, everyone, you know, here in Boston, the Boston area, you know, thinks of him as a nice person. And if you're trying to picture Andy Card, you listeners, you might remember the image of him whispering in the president's ear on 9/11 as the president continued to read from a book to children. Critics said, you know, instead of whisking the president out of the room as the country was being attacked, some say he should have gone then. Do you think, Andy Natsios, that Andy Card was the man for the job?
Andy Card was the ideal person for the job because in the past, most chiefs of staff don't last very long in either Democratic or Republican administrations. He has been in that position a long time, one, because he's had the complete trust of the president, but two, he's a person of very high ethical standards. He is a person who's a very good manager. And I like to call him a manager of an iron fist in a velvet glove. You know, he would have to fire people, he'd have to discipline people, but when that happened, I am told that it was done in a way that didn't devalue people. And that's very difficult kind of skill set to find.
Well, President Bush, as we know, is famously loyal to people close to him. How hard do you think it was for him to make this change?
Well, I think Andy and the president probably had a long discussion about it. I just don't know. I talked to Andy this morning before it was announced. He called me early this morning to tell me that they had made this decision. And
what did he say?
Well, he just told me what was going to happen. We didn't have time to go into the details of it or what the discussion was. And if I had, I wouldn't be telling you anyway.
That's right.
It's a confidential question.
Well, tell us this. You left this administration, as we said, recently criticized the reconstruction effort in Iraq in Newsweek. You called it a botched effort.
No, actually, I didn't call it a botched effort. That was what Newsweek said it was.
All
I
right.
criticized specific senior-level decisions that would be made by a couple of people. And some people have extrapolated that out inappropriately.
Well, as you look back at the White House, sort of, you know, from this new vantage point, and apparently a White House also in reconstruction, what is your advice to the administration now? What would you say now?
Well, if I were to give advice to the president, it would be privately, and it would not be through the news media, because that's not the way you normally communicate suggestions to high-level people in Washington.
Just a little something?
Well, I would be making lots of suggestions. I've made them already. I told Dr. Rice a lot of things, and in fact, she's adopted a number of the proposals that I made to her before I left the administration, and they're her proposals now.
You think more changes should come?
I'm not going to comment on that publicly.
Yeah. Andrew Natsios, former head of the U.S. Agency for International Development. Thanks so much for speaking with us, Andrew.
Thank you.
And we turn on to Michael Cranish, senior national reporter in the Boston Globe's Washington Bureau. And Andrew Natsios, you know, for obvious reasons, couldn't comment. But do you think that this is the first of many changes, Michael?
It could be. But I don't see this, and a lot of observers, I think, if you talk to them, wouldn't see this as a, quote, shakeup, because Andy Card wasn't the Iraq policy person, and a lot of other people certainly had a lot more responsibility for that. He mentioned Condoleezza Rice, who was National Security Advisor, now Secretary of State. If today Donald Rumsfeld had been replaced, that would be seen widely as a shakeup. But, you know, for example, today The Democratic reaction has not really been, you know, that they're glad to see him go. Instead, it's been that they liked him. There was a figure that they basically, you know, liked and trusted in the Bush administration. A lot of Democrats have been calling for other people to be ousted, starting with Rumsfeld and maybe some others. But Card hasn't been the focal point of that anger.
And we heard earlier from Republican strategist Jim Nuzzo, who said that Andy Card wasn't really the chief of staff. He said that Vice President Dick Cheney was. But at the same time, Nuzzo said that Andy Card also gets the blame for White House mistakes, such as the Dubai ports deal or the Harriet Meyer Supreme Court nomination. So parse that for us.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The chief of staff, by definition, is supposed to handle all the staff. There's other people like Karl Rove, who's the deputy chief of staff. He clearly makes a lot of the decisions that are politically tinged. Andy Card has been a loyalist and protector of the Bush family going back to the day in 1988 when Andy Card was working on the senior Bush's presidential campaign and picked up George W. Bush at the airport in Massachusetts to help him work on the Massachusetts primary. And from that time, Andy Card has been very important to the Bush family. He was the deputy chief of staff for the senior President Bush and chief of staff for this one. He also, back in the 88 campaign, it's not well remembered, but he was the person, as a former legislator in Massachusetts, who provided some of the dirt, frankly, on Michael Dukakis, the senior Bush's opponent in that race. And he served a very important role. He's known as Mr. Congeniality, Mr. Nice, but he's also, as Andy Nasio has just mentioned, sort of he's got the fist behind the velvet glove. So he served both roles. The public side of Andy Card that we've seen has mostly been not that public, mostly in the background. The scene he'll be best remembered for, as you mentioned, is that scene where he whispered in the president's ear when President Bush was reading a book to second graders in Florida saying that the nation is under attack.
And Michael, I want to take the minute that we have left to look forward to Joshua Bolton. Just sum him up as a future chief of staff.
Well, some people are already describing him as sort of a clone of Andy Card in the sense that he's low-key. He's just as much of a loyalist as Andy Card did. He's just as much of an insider. Here's a person who's serving as the president's head of the budget. So clearly this is not someone brought in from the outside to shake up. So that's why people aren't portraying this, that I've talked to, as a shake up in the traditional sense. You know, the senior President Bush ousted John Sununu as his chief of staff. That was a big shake up. The person who told John Sununu he was leaving was Andy Card. So Andy Card knows very well the role that a chief of staff can play, and he learned from the Sununu matter not to be someone who's in the headlines, play a little bit more behind the scenes, and that's what he's been most of his term.
And we understand that Joshua Bolton has long been as close to the president as, well, I was reading an article in 2001, as Karen Hughes. So this is a close figure.
This is someone who's been close to him for quite a while, not as long as Andy Card, clearly, but someone who's really earned the president's trust, and I don't see that, you know, at least from what I know right now, as someone who's going to shake things up. To the contrary, he was the person pushing Social Security, which was not successful, the overhaul plan. So we'll see if that comes up again.
Michael Cranish, senior national political reporter for the Boston Globe's Washington Bureau. Michael, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Now to Israel, where it's election day and a very important one. Voters essentially deciding the future of the West Bank, which Israel has occupied for 39 years. The leading candidate, Acting Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, is vowing to pull back from most of the West Bank and draw Israel's final borders by 2010. Olmert's centrist Kadima Party is expected to win well ahead of the centrist left, Labor Party, and the right-wing party, Likud. Thanasi Kambanis is covering the Israeli elections for the Boston Globe. He joins us from Jerusalem. And Thanasi, the Associated Press is saying about 31% of voters turned out, but put this in context. It sounds low, and normally Israelis flock to the polls.
Well, the turnout here, I think, has traditionally been as high as 70%. This is a real participatory democracy, nothing like we're used to in the States. So it's been surprising, given how big the issues are, that turnout has been lower, maybe 5 percentage points lower than it was last time around, which had already been the lowest turnout in Israel's history.
Well, and what do you think, you know, why do you think that is? I mean, you mentioned yesterday that there was a sort of inertia because people felt that really they couldn't affect the actual outcome of what happens to their country. You know, they felt it was out of their hands. Are you seeing that reflected at the polls?
Well, today I went out and talked to people in both in a settlement near Jerusalem and then on the campus of Hebrew University, and I heard a little bit of the same kinds of reasons for why people weren't voting, those who had chosen not to vote. And there were two themes that emerged. One was that the big foreign policy questions and the big questions of what's going to happen on the West Bank, these voters feel have already been decided. They feel like the government is going to go the same way no matter who gets elected, withdrawing from most of the West Bank, and that American pressure is going to dictate what Israel does vis-a-vis the Palestinian Authority. So on that issue, they feel like their vote doesn't matter. Then the second strain I heard a lot, particularly from young people, was that Israeli society is riven by really deep social problems, including big divisions between religious and secular people, a lot of poverty and growing unemployment, and a bad public education system. And these young people I talked to felt like none of the parties really had serious platforms or serious leadership on those issues, so it wasn't worth giving their blessing to a government that they felt like wasn't really going to be interested in those issues.
Well, yesterday you also pointed to the Hamas victory in the Palestinian territories as evidence that, you know, it's not over till it's over and surprises could happen. You also mentioned the Shas party and the Russian party, Israel is our home, you know, as parties that are further right than Likud that have had growing popularity because of the Hamas victory. So what are you seeing today?
Well, out when I interviewed people, I was actually surprised to find more Labor voters than I expected, and also more Likud voters than I expected. Again, this is a very unscientific, anecdotal sample from people mm-hmm. I talk to on the street, so let's not infer too much from it. But it seems like the right is in the middle of a very active debate, and I saw outside of polling stations major arguments between Shas, the Russian party, and Likud, arguing for the support of people coming in and out of the polls. So I did see more people speaking for the traditional parties, but also a lot of people speaking for those right-wing parties that seem poised to emerge with about 30% of the Knesset.
Which is important because it's a coalition government and those seats will be important.
Exactly, and because even a party with just 10 seats could end up playing a pivotal role in bringing, say, Kadima to power in exchange for a key ministry and demanding concessions on the national policy platform.
Well, we also spoke with you yesterday about increased security ahead of the elections, and we're hearing today that an adult and a child, Bedouins, Israelis, but Bedouins, Arabs, were killed in Gaza. It appears they were both shepherds. The militant group Islamic Jihad claimed responsibility, saying the attack was intended to disrupt the election. But do you think it did? Do you think that attack or a fear of security, kept people home?
I doubt it. I mean, in this country, people are used to so much violence, and an attack like that, is barely hits the charts. I think if there'd been a major suicide bombing in a city, that might have dampened turnout. But this kind of thing, I don't think does.
As you said, probably sadly. Thanasi Kambanis is covering the Israeli elections for the Boston Globe. He's speaking to us from Jerusalem. Thanasi, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure.
Well, just ahead, quite a news day. While leaders in Washington debate illegal immigration, immigrants, legal and otherwise, have lent their voices to the debate, rallying in communities across the country. We'll speak to a radio host in Los Angeles who told his listeners to take to the streets. Is he worried now about a backlash? Stay with us. Much more coming up here and now. Celebrating a major victory today after the Senate Judiciary Committee last night approved a bill that would legalize 11 million undocumented people living in the U.S. after fulfilling requirements. The bill faces a tough battle on the Senate floor where it was supposed to be considered today, and even if it does pass the Senate, it would need to be squared with a House bill that takes a hard line on border security, making illegal immigrants felons and calling for a 700-mile fence on the U.S.-Mexico border. Well, Los Angeles DJs on Spanish-language radio stations have been using the power of the airwaves to mobilize people to take part in the pro-immigrant rallies. This past week, hundreds of thousands of protesters heeded the call. 500,000 people turned out on the streets of Los Angeles, more than the expected 20,000. We called Ricardo Sanchez, known as El Mandril, or the Baboon. He hosts the Que Buena show on KBUE-FM radio in L.A. I talked to El Mandril through translator Juan José Gutierrez, an interview that was broadcast on their airwaves.
Hi, my name is Mandril.
Hola, bienvenida aquí y ahora.
Aquí ahora.
Bienvenidos también a Los Ángeles, California, a la Qué Buena 105.5 y 94.3.
Welcome to LA, to the Qué Buena 105.5 and 94.3 FM in Los Angeles.
Muchas gracias. El Mandril, I've actually heard you before, and I just wondered, why did you get involved in this, rallying your listeners for the rally? What was it that you heard that most concerned you, that made you want to get involved?
As
a social communicator, as someone that deals with the mass media, and specifically as someone that deals with an audience in a market that's predominantly Spanish-speaking, we suspect most of our radio listeners being immigrants, many of whom are undocumented. We felt it was our obligation to, when asked by the community activists and leaders of our community, to give them an opportunity to speak and discuss their concerns about immigration policy, to invite them to come in.
Are you a legal immigrant?
Yes, I am.
Well, the House bill had already passed when, this rally began, or the push for the rally began, and the House bill would make undocumented immigrants felons, and also is calling for a 700-mile fence along the U.S.-Mexico border. Was that part of your concern, the House bill?
Yes, because I understood that most of the people that cross the American border into the United States from Mexico are hardworking, tax-paying Americans that come to America simply to work, to contribute to society, and to take care of their families. So clearly, yes, that was a great concern of not just myself, but the entire team that works with me in La Que Buena.
But Ricardo El Mandril, what do you say to listeners, maybe, in other parts of the country, who they saw signs, for instance, at the rally saying justice for immigrants, and they would say, well, we're for justice and we're for immigrants as well, but we don't feel that people should be allowed to break the law. It's about illegal immigration. It's about people breaking the law. What do you say to them?
You know, to me, the fact of the matter is that when we look at each other, we begin to realize that everyone, our cousins, our uncles, our ancestors, I mean, all of us at some point were immigrants. And the fact of the matter is that as far as I'm concerned, and this is where I would take issue with those that believe that people that come to this country to work, to have a future for themselves and their children, are illegal. My philosophy is that's absurd. No human being is illegal.
But there are laws.
Well, we have a situation, in a globalized world where many people, because of the current immigration policy, are legally not able to come into the country. They cannot come into this place legally. They are here. That's a fact of life. They are working. They are working very hard, paying taxes. They wish to legalize. They do not want to be undocumented immigrants. And I think that that's what we need to be talking about. We need to be talking about solutions, not about polarizing society. I think that this society already had enough of that. This country has historically incorporated wave after wave of immigrants. It so happens that now the immigrants that are here are predominantly Latinos, and they deserve to be recognized in their humanity and in the work that they're contributing to this society.
Well, Ricardo, your listeners today must be pretty happy. How are your listeners, and how are you feeling today as you're being credited with actually influencing what happened in Washington yesterday at the Senate committee?
I am very, very happy that our work is being recognized. However, I must clarify that it wasn't an individual effort. It was a collective effort. There were many other communicators, from the Spanish-speaking media, who joined hands to make our contribution to the mobilizing effort of March 25th a success. We are all very gratified and happy.
Well, El Mandril, one last question. We understand that March organizers are calling for a boycott of work, school, and shopping on May 1st. They're calling it the Great American Boycott of 2006. I'm wondering if you encourage your listeners to participate in that, but are you worried about a backlash? And I don't want to leave it on a negative note, but some people looked at the numbers of people turning out or the kids who boycotted school yesterday in L.A., and they said that was alarming to a lot of Americans to see just how many people are behind this and perhaps how many illegal immigrants there are. So, you know, briefly, if you will, are you worried about a backlash?
As I said earlier, I mean, we're just social communicators. If there's an important, vital issue that has great concern amongst many in our community and distinguished members of that community, activists, etc., come to us and request that we open up the airwaves so that they can inform and tell people about what actions are in line to be taken in order that we can responsibly address those issues. Our responsibility is not just as individuals and members of the community, but also as members of a market that lives to a large extent from that segment of the community, to open up and to give access so that we can have a rich debate.
That's Juan José Gutierrez, translating for Ricardo Elmandril Sanchez from KBUE-FM. Ricardo Elmandril, muchas gracias por hablar con nosotras.
Muchas gracias, bonita.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the power and the constitutionality of military tribunals for Guantanamo Bay detainees are being considered at the U.S. Supreme Court today in a case that has some calling for a recusal from a second Supreme Court justice, Antonin Scalia. Justices heard 90 minutes of legal arguments instead of the usual 60 this morning in the case of Salim Ahmed Hamdan, the one-time driver for Osama bin Laden, who's been held at the detention center in Cuba following his capture in Afghanistan 2 months after the 9/11 attacks. Now, this case is complicated enough, but it could be further complicated by the recusal of Chief Justice John Roberts and calls for Justice Antonin Scalia to also recuse himself because of controversial comments he made regarding his son's military service in Iraq and his, Scalia's, feelings about enemy combatants. Well, joining on the line to try to parse all of this is Newsweek investigative correspondent Michael Isikoff. Michael, first of all, Scalia heard arguments this morning in this case. Does this mean that he won't recuse himself?
I would imagine it does, given that the letter from the some of the counsel asking him to recuse himself came yesterday, and if in fact he did sit in on it, then it would be a pretty good indication that he's planning to participate and write an opinion. Yeah.
Well, let's just give just a little bit of history in this case. Hamdan, the driver, the alleged driver, sued over the military commissions. He won in district court, but lost in an appeals court decision in which Judge Roberts participated. And because Judge Roberts participated in that lower court, that's why he the Chief Justice,
he has recused himself from the case.
But,
right.
But,
yeah. And the issue with Scalia is, he made comments in Switzerland a couple of weeks ago that seemed to go directly to the issues at stake in the trial, including whether or not there are legal protections either under the United States Constitution or in international law through Geneva Conventions that should be afforded Guantanamo detainees.
Well, tell us what he said, because there is a tape. It started with his dismissive comments about whether detainees have rights under the Constitution. What did he say?
He said that nobody has ever thought that Guantanamo detainees have rights under the United States Constitution. Of course, that is in dispute. The lawyers for Mr. Hamdan, among others, argue that that in fact they do have constitutional protections. Probably the two most problematic things he said, Justice Scalia said, is number one, he said, we are at war. War is war, and nobody ever thinks that people you pick up on a battlefield should be given full jury trials. Well, war, we are at war, is precisely the issue, the threshold issue that the lawyers for Mr. Hamdan are arguing today. They are saying that the congressional authorization to use military force in Afghanistan was not the equivalent of a blank check to the president to wage war. It was specifically tailored to respond to the people who perpetrated the attacks of September 11th. This is the same argument that has come up in the NSA wiretapping issue, whether or not what was passed by Congress in the wake of the September 11th attacks can be properly understood as a as the equivalent of a declaration of war, open-ended war, for the president to use his commander-in-chief powers in all aspects of a military campaign.
Well, that's one of the issues at stake in the case, but let's go back to that moment in Sweden when Scalia was speaking before the audience, Switzerland rather, when Scalia was speaking before the audience, and an audience member challenged him and said, don't the Gitmo detainees have protections under the Geneva or Human Rights Conventions? What did he say back?
Correct, and that's where the second set of comments are, and he says that if you are picked up, if they are picked up by my army on a battlefield, then that's where they belong, presumably Guantanamo. And then he said, I had a son on that battlefield, and they were shooting at my son.
I have the script right here. It says, I'm not about to give this man who was captured in a war a full jury trial. I mean, it's crazy.
Right, exactly. And that appears to be a reference to his son, Matthew Scalia, who served in the U.S. Army in Iraq. And, of course, there are no Iraq prisoners in Guantanamo, but Justice Scalia seems to be lumping the two of them together, the conflict in Iraq and the conflict in Afghanistan and elsewhere in the war on terror. And, you know, probably most problematic, he's talking about his own son, equating the Guantanamo detainees before the court today with the people who were shooting at his son. And I think that's the reason that there were people who felt that these comments ought to have disqualified the justice from participating in the case.
So how does it work? I mean, we understand that justices decide whether or not to recuse themselves.
Right, exactly. There is no higher authority. We are talking about the Supreme Court, and each justice gets to decide on his own whether or not there is a recusal issue. Justice Scalia did recuse himself a couple of years ago from a case involving the Pledge of Allegiance on the grounds that he had made public comments that spoke to the merits of the case before he had heard it. That precedent was cited as something he should follow again in this case, but apparently he has chosen not to, and there is nobody who can tell him otherwise.
Well, we talked about some of the issues at stake in the case that apparently Justice Scalia is going to participate in. You mentioned the reach of the president and whether or not the fact that there is war gives him as full a reach as the White House is claiming. We understand that Justices Scalia and Alito also questioned why a defendant before a military commission should be given the right to challenge the case before a verdict is reached, because that's a right that criminal defendants don't have. Your thoughts on that point?
Well, I think that the threshold issue that the lawyers for the Guantanamo, for Mr. Hamdan, are raising is whether or not the commissions themselves, the trials, are constitutional. These military commissions are sort of streamlined trials with limited rights for the accused. They have some rights, but not the full panoply of constitutional protections. And then the issue becomes how much ought to be they to be given. But they were all created pursuant to a military order signed by President Bush in November of 2001, in which the president was invoking his commander-in-chief wartime powers to try people picked up on the battlefield in the war on terror. And that's why I said before the one central issue here is did what happened in the wake of September 11th, the congressional authorization, is that really equivalent to a declaration of war that gives the president this authority or not? And so the answer to the question that Justices Scalia and Alito were raising is, well, the issue before the court today is not whether or not they are guilty or innocent, but whether the trials themselves are constitutional.
Michael Isikoff, investigative correspondent for Newsweek magazine, and with the court the way it is, there could be a 4-4 ruling anyway, so we will stay on this story. Michael, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. It's time to open up the Here Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. We spoke last week with former Republican strategist Kevin Phillips. In his new book, American Theocracy, he says, among other things, that the Republican Party is in the hands of fundamentalist Christians whose apocalyptic beliefs affect foreign policy. Many of you appreciated the segment. Robin Carpenter of Hanover, New Hampshire, did not. She writes, Kevin Phillips has made a whole second career out of being the bad boy Republican who turned against Republicans. That theme's gotten a bit tired after a couple of decades, so he's come up with a clever twist to freshen it up. Tweak the president with silly taunts about Revelations, Armageddon, and the religious right in general. Okay, he's got a book to sell and a career on life support, but in deliciously condign irony, it's worth noting that this one-time serious analyst finally comes to flogging his books on midday shows sandwiched with discussion of vulva support groups. Ouch. That last comment is a reference to our piece on Eve Ensler's current stage play about body image. It's called The Good Body. And yes, as Eve said, if you can believe such a thing exists, she found a vulva support group. Well, Paul Kane, a Marine and a fellow at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government, wrote after we spoke with Sabrina Eaton of the Cleveland Plain Dealer as President Bush prepared to speak in Cleveland, a city hit hard by the Iraq War. Paul writes, I was surprised that Sabrina Eaton would misstate that the Americans killed from just outside her city were National Guard, they were all Marines, and that Ms. Eaton would say about a dozen, a whole bunch all at once, were killed, like she was discussing cabbage and not war dead. The facts are that 14 men were killed in one explosive device attack in August. An additional 17 were also killed, for a total of 41 dead from Ohio's 25th Marine Reserve Regiment. It trivializes sacrifice in war to not be accurate about the who, what, how many aspects of men killed in action. Words matter. Well, speaking of which, it would be easier to name those of you who didn't call after I twice referred to a young man as an alumni of George Mason University. Yeesh. One guy is an alumnus, two or more alumni. One woman, alumna, two or more alumni. Mixed male and female are nigh as well, although according to Webster's, some schools have started using alumni. And David Childcred of Chandler, Arizona adds, why can't we just say graduates? Well, we heard from Lauren Mazzella of Weston, Massachusetts, after our interview with author David Laskin about the Children's Blizzard of 1888.
It made me think about my grandfather, William Blizzard Weilberg, who was born during the blizzard of 88 on the kitchen table because his mother went to the hospital and they sent him back home. And I wanted to name my son with the middle name Blizzard, but we decided against it. My husband didn't want to do it.
Was Blizzard really his middle name?
It was. It was his given name.
Isn't that something? Well, Lauren, thank you very much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, Janet Brownstein of Grosse Pointe Park, Michigan, wrote us yesterday after our conversation on the absence of young black men from the job market. We spoke with two professors who pointed to the hip-hop culture as a factor. Now, Janet agreed with Harvard's Orlando Patterson that young African Americans need to be broken of an addiction to the culture as they get older. But she took exception to Columbia professor Ron Mincy's implication that it was somewhat hypocritical of society to buy the products of the hip-hop culture, but not hire those who live the culture. She writes, most of us adults do not admire hip-hop culture or understand its dialect. I don't want to be served by someone I can't understand. I'm sorry, but they must learn to use mainstream speech and behavior if they want jobs.
It's 3 a.m.
Incoming. Last week, we consulted with Dr. Nicholas Dodman of Tufts University to find out what to do because my cat won't let me sleep. He recommended behavior modification and the supplement melatonin with, of course, a doctor's supervision. Well, many of you wrote with your own suggestions, but we're going with S. Jane Arntz's. She writes, regarding your cat problem, shut the bedroom door. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now.
Yes, I love you too, but it's 3 o'clock. You're sitting on my head.
the sound of great jazz. It signals the arrival of Here and Now jazz aficionado James Isaacs, who's brought with him three new treats from two elder statesmen of jazz and one youngish lion. James, what are we listening to right now?
Well, Robin, hello again. And we're listening to one of the treats by one of the elder statesmen, the drummer and composer Paul Modian, or if you prefer, Paul Motion. Mm-hmm. He turned 75 on the 25th of March. And this is from his new album, Garden of Eden, on the ECM label. The piece is called Pithecanthropus Erectus, and it's by Charles Mingus.
We know Paul, a drummer, composer, band leader. He worked with Bill Evans in the 60s, Keith Jarrett.
Mm-hmm, in the 70s.
Made albums as a leader, but let's settle something. Is it Motion or Modian? How do you say his name?
Well, it is Modian. He is of Armenian extraction, so the correct pronunciation is, in fact, Modian. Mm-hmm. When I first heard him in the early 60s with Bill Evans, he was Paul Modian. Mm-hmm. But as the years passed, people who didn't know how to pronounce the name called him Motion, and I guess he liked it because it stuck. He is now Paul Motion. And after all, drummers do create rhythmic motion. So
it
there
works.
You have it. Yeah.
It works. And he works. What makes him so innovative?
Part of what gives his approach to drums such flair is that as a young man growing up in Providence, Rhode Island, he played a lot of Armenian dance music, and that music uses unusual time signatures. So Paul Motion, Modian, didn't approach the basic rhythmic unit of 4-4 time in the traditional sense. Now, what do I mean by that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think that he was one of the first drummers not to play the steady ching-chinga-ching cadence on the ride cymbal. He was playing flow, he was playing pulse, he was not playing time in a strict manner, and his playing has this beautiful looseness about it that I love.
Tell us a little more about Pithecanthropus Erectus, the Mingus tune.
Okay, it was originally recorded by Charles Mingus's Jazz Workshop in 1956, and this is, I guess you could call it program music, because Mingus wanted it to depict man arising from the primordial ooze and then walking on two feet. The original version was more aggressive than this version by the Paul Motion Band. I would call this new rendition more misterioso. And the two tenor players, Chris Cheek and Tony Malaby, state the theme in their lower registers. And when they do that, they roll in like an eerie fog. And behind them, the three guitar players kind of simmer quietly. And then you've got Paul Motion's unusual sounding snare drum providing accents. It's the Paul Motion Band, again from the new ECM album, Garden of Eden.
Very haunting sound from the Paul Motion Band. What's next, James?
Well, Robin, we've got a younger guy this time, 37-year-old multi-reed man and composer Chris Potter, who's got a relatively new working band currently touring America.
Who has he played with?
Well, he made his bones with the brilliant quintet of the bassist composer Dave Holland, and Holland's band was easily one of the best and most important improvising groups of the past decade. And before that, Chris Potter was with Paul Motion's Electric Bebop Band, so it kind of ties together, at least a little bit. Chris Potter is a virtuoso, but he's not a show-off. And while he can play a number of different reeds, this new disc for Sunnyside called Underground features him only on tenor saxophone.
And the tune we're going to hear?
It's called Nudnik, and this is a Chris Potter original. The idiom in which they're working this time around, muscular, funk, jazz fusion rhythms from the 1970s, The music is very complicated, let me check that, and it's filled with unexpected twists and turns and accents. If you're the drummer in this band, Nate Smith, you've got to be up for the downstroke and on your toes. And this guy, Nate Smith, can really handle it.
Chris Potter from his new CD, Underground. So, to your third artist today, and James, I have to confess I have not heard of Gerald Wilson.
Well, in a way, Robin, that's understandable because I'm guessing that you and many of our listeners don't listen to many jazz orchestras as opposed to small groups. Plus, Gerald Wilson, a composer, an arranger, and a former trumpet player who is now 87 years old, has lived most of his life in Los Angeles. He hasn't appeared very often in the East, at least as far as I know. And it's because he's been so busy writing for films and TV. But during the 1960s, Wilson recorded a superb series of big band albums for the Pacific Jazz label. This new album, In My Time, is on the Mac Avenue label, and he came to New York to record with some of the city's elite jazz players. Some of them are veterans, some young lions. And I would say that since the death of Benny Carter at age 95, Gerald Wilson is our most consistently stimulating writer for larger ensembles. And this entire album is in every way of the highest quality.
Oh, we've got to give him his props at the age 87. I understand we're going to hear something from the Gerald Wilson Orchestra called Lomeline?
Lomeline.
What is that?
Well, it's not a what. It was a who.
Ah.
Antonio Lomeline. He died 2 years ago, age 59. And I understand he was one of Mexico's very greatest matadors. Gerald Wilson has long been a bullfighting aficionado, and while I don't share his enthusiasm for that sport or art or whatever one wants to call it, bullfighting has inspired Wilson over the years. He's written several powerful originals, like the one I've selected. The trumpet soloist here is John Faddis, and I think he captures the bravado, the courage, or whatever one chooses to call what a matador does when he faces the bull in the ring. And what an unbelievable upper register that John Faddis has. He's featured now, Gerald Wilson Orchestra, Lomeline.
The Gerald Wilson Orchestra, one of three selections that jazz aficionado James Isaacs has brought us. That James, always an eye-opener, and we'll have all of them on our website, here-now.org. James, thank you as always.
Robin, as always, my pleasure. Hope to see you soon.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here.